Hey, welcome to the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Glad to have you with me one more time. I'm chuckling as we come into this intro because I have recut this little piece of digital tape, six, seven times. I just couldn't find the right words, kids, so hopefully this sticks. Time to go up the down staircase in the outdoor, look for the obvious, buried in the absurd, find sense in the senseless. Hold on to your lug nuts. Time for an overall. I'm just being dirt honest with you. You know, this sounds great when I'm all done editing, but you should hear me fumble through some of this stuff. Maybe part of the reason it's 9,000 degrees in Chicago. My energy is sapped. It's so hot, I saw a dog chasing a cat. They were both walking. You know what I'm saying? That's pretty hot. Anyway, I've really been waiting to do this show for a few weeks, and there's other things getting in the way and other projects I got going on, and I had to have this sit. But let me just tell you, this is a real honor to have Tom Dreesen on the show today. He's got a new book out. We'll get to all that in a second. But real quick, I met Tom in 2018 at an event here in Chicago at the Union League Club for the Illinois Fatherhood Initiative. And David Hirsch, who is the guy that created the Illinois Fatherhood Initiative and the 21st Century Dads Foundation, and a guy that I helped put his book together, who, by the way, had nothing better to do except ride his bike from Santa Monica to Chicago to raise money and awareness for the devastating effects of what happens when kids grow up without a dad. A lot of problems in that. But anyway, Dave has been at this since 1997, and I was very honored to help him build that book out, and it's done some great things in the world. And he was having this big event at the Union League Club, and he was supposed to be there, and I don't know what happened, but he couldn't make it. And he asked if I would sit in and take his place, and Tom Dreesen was the master of ceremonies there. Here's a guy. Now, I'm talking a little bit more Chicago here because me and Tommy, we're going to talk here in just a couple of seconds. You're going to hear it. But anyway, after serving in the Navy, he's working as an insurance salesman back in 1968. He meets Tim Reed, and the two teamed up as Tim and Tom. They were the first biracial stand-up comedy duo in the United States. That's some pioneering shit right there. Of course, you know Tim Reed went on to great fame in WKRP in Cincinnati. And Tom, well, he kind of was Frank Sinatra's opening act for 14 years. He did pretty well with himself. It's a long way from Little Harvey, Illinois, which is a suburb not far from where we're sitting here today talking. And it's an amazing, his book, by the way, I got to tell you, you have to get this. I'm going to gush all over this. First of all, it's written from a very honest perspective. He doesn't pull any punches in the air. It's not sugarcoated. The book is called Still Standing, My Journey from Streets and Saloons to the Stage and Sinatra. That's just like a part of what this is all about. The streets and saloons part grabbed my attention more than the stage in Sinatra, I've just got to tell you. You know, as a Chicago guy myself, I know what it's like to have to work from the bottom up, but not like Tom worked from the bottom up. I mean dirt poor bottom up to the top. So while it's a great book about Sinatra, and, you know, there's some great things in there about some of the other celebrities he's worked with, I got to tell you, this podcast is built on improving our lives. That's why it's called Life 2.0, like the next level stuff. So while the celebrity stuff's great and the Hollywood stories are great and hanging out with Frank and the Rat Pack, that's all great. What's really greater than that are the life lessons that this guy has had to live and implement and overcome to be where he's at now. So without further ado, the book is called again, Still Standing, My Journey from Streets and Saloons to the Stage and Sinatra. A couple weeks ago, I caught up with Tom Dreesen, and it sounded like this.
Hello.
Hey, Tom, it's John. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, John. How you doing?
I'm good. This book's just something else. I was.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I don't want all the pleasantries. I mean, but man, I was so struck by how you grew up that I got goosebumps reading this. And that's not easy for a Chicago guy to get goosebumps, if you get my drift.
Well, I really appreciate that. That's a good sign. You're right. Goosebumps have always been a good indication to me when I got them that this meant something. You know, right. That's really nice. Thank you.
I got to start at the beginning with this because, you know, Harvey, Illinois, for people who are not from this area, you know, back when you grew up there, it was a pretty rough and tumble place. So one of the things that's most important to me in your book, Still Standing, My Journey from Streets and Saloons to Stage and Sinatra, is the Stage and Sinatra stuff's really cool, but growing up in Harvey was like Hell's Kitchen just outside of Chicago.
Yeah, well, you know, it really was and it wasn't. It was a, when I grew up there, it was really a blue-collar town. There were steel mills and factories. They made everything from clutch plates to crankshafts. There were in taverns, 36 taverns in all, and steel mills like Ingalls and Shepherd, Perfection Gear, Whiting Corporation, Alice Chalmer, you know, Ferroloy Corporation. All these factories where men and women worked. Mm-hmm. And then and almost always would stop at the bar on the way home for a couple of drinks before they go home. But it was a thriving little metropolis, and people worked in Harvey, shopped in Harvey, and banked in Harvey. So it was really a great little town. It was a microcosm to me of the world, you know, and all ethnic backgrounds and everything. And then it slowly, as time went by, it started, the industry started moving out of there. And then in 1968 and 69, they had, you know, the riots all across the land. Right. African Americans were rioting, feeling disenfranchised from the system, and students were protesting the Vietnam War. You know, I had just gotten out of the service at the time. And in the meantime, Harvey had one of the largest riots in the country, and they burned in many city blocks and everything, and it never quite recovered from that. Because once that happens, as it's happening today, industries begin to move out. You know, they're not going to invest millions of dollars in building businesses and for fear that they'd be destroyed. So they move out of the community, you know, and Harvey began to go down. And then the gangs started moving in heavy, the Peacestone Nation and the Blackstone Rangers. And before you know it, there was a murder a day. You know, I mean, I'll tell you something that happened that I'll never forget. And once I start talking, I start babbling. So you can cut me off anytime you want, John.
Go ahead.
But one time, you know, when I came out of the service and I'm getting married and I had kids, I had a real good black friend named Everett Nicholson. We grew up together, and his nickname was Gucci. Mm-hmm. And one night, my wife and I went out to dinner with his wife and him, and we went to a little festival place, and we had dinner. And the woman that waited on us was Everett Nicholson's first wife. Mm. And so we talked for a while and everything. And the next day, I'm sitting at home with my wife having dinner in my little apartment. I had a wife and three kids in those days. And the phone rang, and it was Gucci. And his wife was killed the next night, that night afterward, with a gun that got shot in the head. And I went, oh, my God. And even though it was his ex-wife, it still was the mother of his children. Sure. So I said, oh, my God, and I'm sympathizing with him. And I sat down at the dinner table, and because this was happening frequently in Harvey at the time. And my wife said, who's that? I said, you remember Gucci's first wife? Yeah, she got, oh, my God. And I said, oh, it's just terrible. I said, pass the potatoes. And I said, do you see what I just said? I just said somebody from my childhood was shot and killed past the potatoes. It's become commonplace in Harvey that these things are happening. That years ago, if someone broke their arm, everybody in the neighborhood would be rushing over with pies and stuff, and can I help, can I, you know. And that's what we came to, that I said someone I knew since childhood was shot and killed last night past the potatoes. I had to get up and walk around, because I was realizing we're taking this as commonplace. We're accepting this, that this is the way life is, you know.
And Tom, that's decades ago, and one of the underlying themes, and there's so many in this book, was the interracial relationships that you had with the people in the neighborhood and your friend. And this runs throughout the whole book. And this is one of the reasons I told you, whether I kept it or not, that I got goosebumps, because you could have never predicted that decades later that this stuff would still be going on. This book almost seems, I'm going to just come this side of ordained, like it was ordained to come out, because while the comedy's great, the stories are great, Sinatra's great, you're great, it's all great, but this underlying theme of having two races get together is like the thread that runs through the book, Tom.
Yeah, well, that was, you know, I was fortunate. That was my experience. I grew up, you know, I know it sounds cliche and all the other stuff, you know, but I just saw friends, when you say, I never saw color, that's kind of a stupid remark, because of course you too see color, but it was only for a moment, and then second, I saw a human being, and as a little boy, I was curious about everything, and when I first moved into the neighborhood with all the other black kids, because my family was always poor, so we lived in the poor side of town, I just, my relationships and my friendships, grew from there, and throughout my whole life, it was that way. I just saw things differently than most people that I was growing up with, anyhow, it was a great experience, and it still is to this day. Those childhood friends are still mine. Many of them are gone now because I'm getting up in years, but they remain my friends through the years, The guy I just mentioned, Everett Nicholson, Gucci, I talked about him in my act, he became a real good real good friend. He loved it. I talk about him on the Tonight Show and on different shows,
Well, the way you grew up, trying to put this into some semblance of order, you take your entire life and you put it in 300 some odd pages, which is a difficult task enough as a writer and the people that you work with to put this book together, to take these select memories you had and experiences to pull this off. But, most people today don't grow up like you grew up, meaning that you talk about coming from hardscrabble background. You talk about poor, like living in a shack poor, not just that you didn't have color TV.
Yeah, we didn't. We had no bathtub, no shower, no hot water. It was a rat-infested, roach-infested shack. My brother and I, rats used to dig holes around the side of the house, and my brother and I would go get bottles, and we'd break them and put them in the rat holes. Well, the rats would just dig more under there, but we were raggedy poor. I had holes in my shoes as big around as a coffee cup, as far back as I can remember, when I first went in the Navy, the day I turned 17, I went in the Navy. I could not get over that I could stand under a shower, hot water, and let as much hot water flow on me as I wanted. To this day, John, and I'm not making this up, to this day, there's two things that just give me such a calming effect. One is, of course, getting in a shower and letting as much hot water flow on me as I want for as long as I want. And the other is to go into a closet and see I have more than one pair of shoes.
Wow.
Because I never had more than one pair of shoes, And in the Navy, of course, they gave me several pair of shoes, boondockers and dress shoes. And my own bed, clean sheets in my own bed. I mean, it was, and then the eating 3 scores a day. We never ate in that shack. We had hardly ate. It was always catch as catch can. But I remember guys used to complain about the food. Can I swear on it without being vulgar?
Yeah,
go ahead. Well, no, what they called morning breakfast shit on a shingle, and that was ground beef on toast, and then the other would be they called it foreskins on toast, was a cream ham. So the guys used to complain. I thought I was eating, pheasant under the glass. Thought, how could they be complaining about this food?
I remember reading in there that the first time was at the Black Hawk restaurant. You had the first steak in your life.
Yeah. Well, we never had steak at all when I was a kid. The number one delicacy you might have would be chicken, fried chicken. That was kind of a big deal if we had that once in a while. But when I first went in the service, and I remember being in New York City with my buddy who came from Colorado, and he said, "Boy, I'm dying for a good steak." And I went to the restaurant with him, and he said, "How do you like a steak?" I didn't know. He said, "Well, what kind of steak do you like?" I said, "I don't know what kind of steak." He said, "You don't know what kind of steak?" I had never eaten a steak. I didn't know a filet from a New York strip. I didn't know any of those things, And then he said, "Well, how do you like it? Do you like it medium?" Well, I said, "I don't know. I don't know how I like it." But the first thing I did when I came out of the service is I went straight there and got a steak.
Did you? it's one thing to have the physical pieces around you of a difficult life with the shack and the rats and the whole thing and no shoes and all the other things that you had to put up with, but it was also difficult. And I remember a couple years ago, you and I were on the stage for the Illinois Fatherhood Initiative here at the Union League Club, and you were telling a story about how difficult it was because your father was an alcoholic, and you were talking about how unbearable that was at times. And I kept wondering, I don't know if we ever, now I have a chance to ask you, all these years later, you see how that affected you, it affected your family and the rest. Do you ever see, has time changed the way you see that time with your father at all, or is it pretty much the same as it's always been?
You mean in my life or
Now you're seasoned and years have gone by and you see how life was back then. While there's no, my mom was an alcoholic. I mean, I get it. So I want, as time goes on for me, I've seen her in a different light because of the times. Has that changed at all for you with your dad?
Yeah, you know, by the way, I never was angry with my father. Yeah. I never was, never. He was a docile guy.
Yeah.
You know, Walter Dreesen was a docile guy. He was not a fighter, not a scrapper. He was a good guy, but weak, obviously weak, and was not a good father. Alcohol was more important to him, and there would be times he'd be sitting in a warm bar, and us kids would be freezing in that shack we lived in with no heat and stuff like that. So I didn't respect him as a father. I didn't dislike him as a man. He was weak.
Right.
You know, I learned from that. But the other thing, too, is I made sure I wasn't that kind of a father. You know, my father never put his arms around me. He never said, I love you. He never took me to a ball game. He never played ball. Never did any of those things. And I tried to be that. Oftentimes I'm asked, I've been doing interviews for 50 years, but people say to me, what would you like on your tombstone? And I don't even hesitate. He was a good father.
Yeah.
If you could say that about me, I would, you know, that would be fine. He was a good father because I know what it's like not to have a good father.
Right.
And by the way, on the spiritual side, John, when I went to Catholic school, I was 6 years old when I first went to Ascension School in Harvey, and the nuns taught us to pray. And something overwhelmed me, even in first grade. The nuns kept talking about you have a father in heaven, God the Father, and that his son came here to tell you about his father, and even had the prayer that they taught us, the Lord's Prayer, our Father who art in heaven. And as a little boy, I kept thinking, I have a father in heaven. You know, as a little boy, you grasp those things. You mean I could, the nun said, yes, you can talk to him anytime you want. I could get on my knees and ask my father in heaven to help me. And that's what I did throughout the year. And by the way, that's what I do even to this day. Every single night before I go to bed, I get on my hands and knees and I pray to my to my Father in heaven, you know. And because I always felt when I had a problem that was so overwhelming that I had no place to go, that the nuns taught me to ask your Father in heaven to help you. And I believe, you know, I strayed from it for years. I drank in bars and I strayed, and then I'd go back, and then I'd stray, and then I'd go back. But now, at the end of my life, as I look back, I truly, really believe all that. As I have the same faith that I had when I was a little boy in first grade, that I've got a Father in heaven, and I've gone to him. I can't tell you how many times. Well, you read the book, you know.
It's really astounding because I just such impact to take your life, which is really remarkable. It's almost like the incredible journey. I mean, against all odds, you've become this, for lack of a better term, icon in America when it comes to comedy and doing things that most people couldn't pull off anymore. I mean, those days have kind of come and gone where you work your way up the ranks and make this, you know, long-standing career. You've been doing it for so long. And I keep thinking about, you know, one turn here or there, a left turn here, a right turn here. If you don't hear the right thing here, or you miss something here, some of this stuff doesn't happen. Do you ever think about the pivot points that pointed you in a direction? Maybe you should have gone left and right, or it just worked out in the way that you think it should have?
Yeah, you know, I think there's so many times in the 14 years I toured with Frank Sinatra as his opening act, I turned down more sitcoms than most comedians get offered in a lifetime. I turned down more opportunities like that. And so I wonder, what if I would have done that? Well, then I wouldn't have been able to do this. And then finally, and then you say, you know what? Ever since I was a kid, I was on my hands and knees saying, God, show me the way. So this was the way. If you have to believe that, this was the way. I remember years ago, Mitch Albom wrote a book called The Five People You'll Meet in Heaven.
Yep.
It was kind of fascinating, but it basically was, there are things you did in your life. You have no idea that you changed someone's direction. You may have, every morning you got up and you went to the corner, went left and got a newspaper, but one morning you went right to put a letter in the mailbox and you bumped into somebody, you said something to them that they passed that on to someone, that passed that on to someone, that before you know it, that other person found the cure to cancer, who knows,
I don't know.
So you don't know any of these things, and you get that, and what you're saying, when you got to heaven, there was people saying thank you, and he said thank you, I don't even know you, yes, you don't remember, but you did this, they did that. So there's a rhyme and a reason for everything, you know, that you know what, sometimes I'll get down to my car and I got to run somewhere and I go, oh, doggone it, I left my keys upstairs or I left my cell phone. Now I go all the way back and I'm, you know, complaining, but I think, wait. Maybe the reason that you're going to be a minute late is because there was a truck turning in a corner up on the freeway that was going to hit you. But now this minute that you had to go back in your keys saved that from happening. So, you know, I always believe this, you know, everything is for a rhyme and for a reason.
Agreed, you know? Agreed. You know, not to pat ourselves on the back too much, but when we had that event at the Union League Club, David Hirsch was supposed to be there and he couldn't make it. And he asked if I would sit in, and instead of you interviewing him, you interviewed me. And we had a great conversation. And a woman came up afterwards and said, you two should have do a motivational show together. I don't know if you remember this. And I said, listen, I'm not cut out for this stage stuff. This is the guy over here. And she said, no, but you both sound like regular people. And reading your book, I started looking about all the jobs that you've done, the construction jobs and the city inspector and all these type of things. I'm thinking, maybe part of Tom Dreesen's success is because he's remained a regular guy. Does that ring true with you?
Well, I appreciate that. A couple of things. One is in the book, as you know, I was having dinner in Patsy's restaurant in New York with Frank Sinatra, and a reporter from the New York Times who had done a story on me saw me, and he was leaving, and he walked by the table. I said, Lonnie, jokingly said to Frank, what do you keep Tom Dreesen around for all these years? And Frank said, you mean besides the fact that he's funny? And the guy said, yeah, besides that. He said, well, if I'm a saloon singer, then I am. And I am. He said, then Tommy's a saloon comedian. Mm. By that, I mean, we're just a couple of neighborhood guys.
Yeah.
And I've always treasured that because that's what I've always thought that I am. No matter, I'm just a neighborhood guy. I'm the guy who tends bar at the corner bar. I grew up on the streets. I don't have a doctorate. I don't have a degree from academia, but I got a doctorate from the streets. Just that no matter where I go, no matter what I do, and I know it sounds like humble BS, but it's true, I always perceive where I'm at through the eyes of that little boy. Mm. If I close my eyes, I see a little boy with a shoe shine box trudging through the snow, going from tavern to tavern, trying to shine shoes and make enough money to feed his brothers and sisters. I'm that little boy, and I perceive the world from the eyes of that little boy. So I appreciate the comment because I really do feel like I'm just a neighborhood guy, you know.
Well, the work ethic is everything, and I don't know if that's still as prevalent as it was when you grew up. My dad taught me a lot of that stuff, too. I think of what I do as a way to pay for the space I take up while I'm here. And I always got a sense, you know, you've had over 60-plus shots on The Tonight Show, right? 60 or more?
Yeah, 61 appearances, yeah.
And every time you go out there, you had to be pinching yourself going, this is a long way from Harvey.
Oh, yeah. Well, I did that so many times in my career, pinch myself. I mean, flying in Frank Sinatra's jet,
yeah.
You know, all over the world. When I came out of the service, I was a bartender in those bars where I used to shine shoes. And at nighttime, I'd be locking up the bar, and some of my buddies would stay in the bars while I was changing putting stuff in the freezer and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Just cleaning up the place. And we'd on the jukebox, Frank would be on the jukebox singing, come fly with me, let's fly away. And my buddies would be saying, man, what would that be like? Can you imagine that, flying with Frank, Sammy, and Dean? And we'd be fantasizing. I wasn't in show business at the time. Yeah, whatever. They live. And years later, I'm flying with Frank. And I toured with Sammy, and I did the Dean Martin shows, you know. And I'm flying with Frank, and he's saying, we're going to knock him dead in Chicago, Tommy. And he used to sock me on the jaw lightly and say, I love you, Tom. And I would look out the window and pinch myself. I can't believe somebody. You know, the reason why I stayed with Frank Sinatra after all those years, he never knew how much in awe of him I was.
Wow.
Because I never let him see it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you think of the times that when I was on stage and he after I finished my show in Vegas, Tahoe, Reno, Atlantic City, and I'd say, good night, everybody. As I left, the band would be playing me off as I'm exiting stage right. Frank would be crisscrossing. He'd come across, I'd be walking mm-hmm. off stage. He'd be walking on stage by me, and he'd get to center stage and he'd say, Tommy, come back and take another bow. Tommy Dreesen, ladies, there he is. This is my main man.
Man.
I don't know how many times I'd say, I can't believe this is happening to me. And it happened for years, but you never get over that. I never let him know.
Yeah.
Because he had, I picked up on this when I first met him. I don't know whether my bartender's instinct or whatever, but that he had enough fans.
Yeah.
He didn't want another fan. He didn't want somebody gaga after he'd come. Hey, you were great. Oh, man, Frank. If I could only tell everybody that I'm turning, I didn't act like that.
Yep.
You know, even though I felt like that sometimes. But I always said, hey, good show tonight. Yeah, and shoot the Cubs did today, what?
Yeah,
and then
we'd be
talking about stuff like that, you know.
He just needed a regular guy. Needs something to bounce stuff off. All these chapters in these books are great. The book is called Still Standing, My Journey from Streets and Saloons, and he isn't kidding. to the stage in Sinatra. And my favorite chapter, as it pertains to so many things, is chapter 13. It starts like this. Let me now share an American fairy tale that happens to be true. Once upon a time in America, there was a young black man and a young white man who were so idealistic and so naive that they honestly believed if they could get people to sit down and laugh together, then maybe, just maybe, everyone could live together too. What's chapter 13 about, Tom?
But Tim Reed and I, you know, meeting, and it changed my life. You know, had I not met Tim Reed, I wouldn't be on this phone with you right now. My whole life changed. You know, I was wandering aimlessly when I came out of service, working from one job to another. I was never happy, could not find what it was I wanted to do. I was a truck driver. I was a bartender. I worked construction. I worked on the loading dock, loading trucks. I later dropped my card from being a teamster to being management, and I was a foreman on a loading dock. I was city inspector for the city of Harvey. I sold life insurance. I was a photographer. I was a private detective. I went from one job to another.
You were a private detective.
Yeah, in Polizzi Detective Agency. I was a private detective. He hired only street kids.
Yeah.
And he got more information that way. But it was just all these jobs, and each one was never fulfilling to me. And at the time, I was honestly praying, saying, God, what is it I'm supposed to be doing? This can't be it. I'd be in a bar at 1 o'clock in the morning with my buddies drinking beer, and I'm saying, I don't belong here. But the pain was I didn't know where I belonged. And that was an emptiness in me. And so I would pray. I said, it must be something I can be doing. Lo and behold, I'm in a civic group. I joined a civic group called the JCs, Junior Chamber of Commerce in those days. And they attacked the problems of the community. Whatever problems were going on in the community, you attack that problem. You would learn. They taught you how to serve on a committee, how to chair a committee, and doing so, making Harvey a better place to live in by attacking the problems. One of the problems, then as in now, were drugs in our youth. So I wrote a drug education program teaching grade school children the ills of drug abuse with humor, a concept I had: get the kids laughing, and then play some records, and then plant the seeds once we got their attention. And helping me at that time. That I'm praying, God, what is it I'm supposed to be doing? Helping me with me on that project, I was pitching it one night at the JC's meeting that I wanted the JC chapter to sanction it as a JC project. And I'm pitching it to the general membership, and helping was a white guy named John DeBoer. Well, the JC's approved of it, run the project. After the meeting, a young black guy comes up to me and says to me, I'm a new member, I just joined tonight, and I'd like to help you on that project. I said, gee, I've already got a guy, but thank you. And the next day, John DeBoer, as divine intervention would have it, said, I can't do that job, Tommy. I got a new job. I can't help you with that program. I just got a new job. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, what was that black guy's name? Oh, yeah, Tim Reed. I called Tim up. Yeah. He and I start working on the project. Now, we went in the classroom for the first time. And the moment we walked in that classroom, I went, oh, my God. Tim, the children were black and white. And here was a young black guy and a young white guy coming in to talk to them. We got their attention immediately. And we played off of one another and made each other laugh. He made me laugh. I made him laugh. We had a lot of fun together. Then we'd plant the seeds. One day, a little eighth grade girl said, you guys are funny. You ought to become a comedy team. And the thought of a black-white comedy team intrigued us because no one had ever done that. And that's, you know, we became America's first black and white comedy team. Thus, what you just said, once upon a time in America, there was a young black man and a young white man who were so idealistic and so naive that we honestly thought if people could just sit down and laugh together, maybe they could live together. Mm-hmm. Now, the year was 1969. The Jets were Super Bowl champions. You know, Sesame Street made its debut on TV. John Wayne won the Academy Award in a movie called True Grit, and Butch Cassidy Robert Redford
Newman.
Paul Newman were breaking box office records with Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. The Vietnam War was raging, all that. But they're in riots. And we went on stage, and the fourth time we ever went on stage, a guy put a lit cigarette on Tim's face and tried to beat the hell out of me. And I boxed when I was in the service, but he outweighed me by 100 pounds and pummeled me, you know.
Yeah.
And we get in the car that night. I'm all beat up, and Tim's scarred up. And Tim looked at me, and he said, welcome to show business.
You know, one of the other things about this book, it's a time capsule for me. And one of the big ahas for me in life is all about perspective. And I was reading your book. You know, you hear this all the time, you know, if we could just go back to the good old days. And I'm always like, well, when exactly was that? Because it all depends on how you look at it. What was going on in that time? And 1969 you brought up as an example was, you know, in 68, 69, 68 was Democratic convention here in Chicago, and, you know, Daley unleashed the dogs on people literally, and 69, all, you know, all this was going on, and just a year earlier, as I mentioned, in 68, so RFK is shot, Martin Luther King Jr. shot, a lot of upheaval in our history, in our society, always has been. So how was it difficult for you going back to that time, which maybe, I can't say for sure, Tom, but maybe even more volatile than today? How difficult was it for you to, well, even though I had the great idea and it was you're breaking color barriers, to stick together in spite of all that was put in your way? Some guy from the Bears practice squad wanted to beat the crap out of you guys.
Yeah, well, you know what it was for us, and it reminded me of being in the service, that when you serve with guys, you know, there's an old, you see a lot of movies where two guys in a foxhole or something that's, you know, for God and country, yeah. And I'm not taking that away, but the truth is, when the shit hits the fan, yeah. It's, I got your back, John, and you got mine.
Right.
I'm going to get you home, you get me home. You know, and so you bond through hardship, or you don't. You know, Tim and I, we bonded. You know, I got your back, and you got mine. And by the way, we weren't going out preaching to America. We weren't going out and giving lectures. We were just trying to make people laugh.
Yeah.
That's all we wanted to do. And I'll tell you this, and I say this all the time, and Tim will agree with me on this. At the end of your life, if you know, first of all, Emerson said, you live the good life if you leave the world better than you found it. I can't tell you that I don't care about any awards. Never did I. And through my career, I've gotten all kinds of plaques and awards and stuff. But this meant more to me and also to Tim. I can't tell you how many times after our performance somewhere that a young black guy would come up and say, you know what? I got a white friend that I'd like to reach out to, but if I do, the brothers are going to wear me out. But watching you and Tim on stage, I'm going to reach out to my white friend. Then a white kid would come up and say, you know, I got a black friend, and I really want to be friends with him, but, you know, the white guys are going to razz me and give me a bad time. But, you know what, after watching you and Tim, I'm going to reach out to my black friend. And more, that happened to us more than you'll ever know. And if they got that, if we, through laughter, they saw that kinship, and we destroyed every stereotype out there. Today, the politically correct police would run us out of town on a rail.
I'm sure they would. You know, this is what I'm saying. So while it was so volatile then, there were things that could be done. And as you said, things have tightened up so much that you couldn't take a step left or right, up, down, in or out, black or white, and not be pummeled. So when you look at it back then and you see, because I've seen your stuff and I watch what you do, and this book just proves it more and more. It's almost like you're in disguise. You're this guy making everybody laugh, but you have these very serious undertones. I'm sure you know this. One is your faith. One is about change. One is about relationships between people. One's for kids. And I watch these things, and it's like, yeah, I know that you're there to make us laugh, but you got to also be thinking at some point, maybe not directly, certainly maybe indirectly, that you're also teaching us things because of your experiences.
Well, you know, isn't that the best kind of comedy where somebody laughs and laughs and they're on their way home and they go, you know what? I never thought about that way. You know, it's through humor that we can educate sometimes. You know, if you're the funny thing is, if you're sitting in the audience and there's a Jewish comedian on stage and he's talking about his Jewish mom and dad and how he was raised Jewish, and you're like me, an Irish Italian kid from Chicago, you say, well, I'm not Jewish, but you know, my mom did stuff like that. Mm. You know, I'm not Jewish, but my dad is. What we find out through humor is how much we have in common. You know,
yeah.
And that's what the comedians. You know, that they are, you know, they are in so many ways healers, you know, and not to get too deep into it, but there was a man named Norman Cousins who wrote the book Laughter Math, and he wrote another book called The Anatomy of an Illness.
Yep.
And he was the editor of Saturday Review, and I'm sure you know the story, but he, through years of stress and negative input, he ended up in the hospital with a heart condition, and the doctors told him he was going to die. And he laid in the hospital, and he thought, if negative input, stress made me ill, then positive input should make me well. So he checked out of the hospital, and he'd only watch I Love Lucy reruns, Candid Camera, Three Stooges, Marx Brothers. He wouldn't watch the evening news. He wouldn't read the papers. He'd listen to comedy albums. He lived 27 years after the doctors told him he was going to die. He literally laughed himself back to health. Because of him, UCLA did some research. We have always known that laughter is psychologically a deterrent, that the brain can't think of two thoughts at the same time. So if you're laughing at a comedian, you're not thinking of your problems. So laughter is a psychological deterrent. Now, because of Norman Cousins, UCLA did research on what happens in the human body when you laugh. you know, after a hearty laugh, you're laughing real hard, and then you go, oh, and a sense of well-being comes over you. Your body's gone through an actual chemical change. They found that the brain releases endorphins into the bloodstream, chemicals that give you that sense of well-being. So there's an actual chemical change comes over your body. Mm-hmm. So laughter is not only psychologically a deterrent, it's physiologically therapeutic. So the comedians are physicians of the soul.
Hmm.
So if you want to call me, you want to call me Dr. Dreesen, it's okay with me, John.
Yeah, okay. Okay, Doc.
Look, I went a long way for that, but that's,
yeah, that's
what I'm saying.
A long
what
era.
A wonderful job. Yeah, what a wonderful job comedians have. What a wonderful life they have and the opportunity they have to make people feel better.
Best prescription. You know, not long ago, here in Chicago, like a lot of places around the country, they'll run the old Tonight shows. And it's on opposite the news, which is a really good thing because there's nothing funny about the goddamn news. So I don't even watch it. And then I'm not that long ago, maybe 6 months ago, I guess it was, I was watching it. And I'm laying in bed and I've got, you know, I'm eating some popcorn and hanging out and watching Johnny do his thing. And a couple things. First of all, I know you know a lot of the people in the business and Leno and Dave did the introduction to your book and all that stuff. But there was something about Johnny Carson, and I could never pinpoint it. He's the only guy I could ever see walk out, say nothing, and people were on the floor. It's like this energy he had. He could stick his hand in his pocket, give a cockeyed look, and the place would fall apart, which was just incredible. To this day, I'm watching these shows that are 30 years old, 40 years old, and I'm laughing, and he hasn't said anything. But not long ago, he introduced you. You come walking out, and this had to be from, I don't know, in the 70s at some point, and you were funny then, and you were funny back when it originally aired, and I texted you that night, and I don't remember what off remark that I had, but I found it fascinating. Thank God that somebody taped all those shows, number one, because here I am laughing 35 years later, 40 years later, at stuff that was going on in the world then that's not unlike what's going on now. But my big setup and long way around, Dr. Dreesen, is what was it like the first night you walked out on The Tonight Show, and how'd that go?
Well, it's hard to describe, except to tell you this. For years, because I read all those books when I was in the service about the power of your mind, mm-hmm. The power of your subconscious mind by Joseph Murphy and all that, I tried to train myself that I was going to walk out on stage and have fun. Every time I went on stage, that I was going to have fun and I was going to be calm. And one of my favorite comedians was Jack Benny,
mm-hmm.
And because a person is an artist in any endeavor when they make their work look, one word, effortless. You know, Jack Benny made comedy look easy.
Yes.
Frank Sinatra made singing look easy.
Yep.
You will be my music. You will be my song. You say, I can do that. No, you can't. He just made it look like you could. And Jack, so that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to have that ease. But that first Tonight Show, I cannot describe the pressure of that first Tonight Show, because 26 million people watched that show in those years. In 1975, wherever you went in America, people say, what do you do for a living? You say, I'm a stand-up comedian. And the next question out of their mouth was, oh, yeah? You ever been on Johnny Carson?
That's it.
If you hadn't been on Johnny Carson in the eyes of America, you weren't a comedian. You might mm-hmm. want to be one or going to be one, but you weren't one now. Now, one appearance on that show, and Freddie Prinze got a sitcom the next day. Everybody knew. That's why all the comedians gravitated to the West Coast in those days, because Johnny Carson moved his show out of New York out to the West Coast in 1972. And one appearance, and your whole life changed.
Yeah.
Now, I'm in the unemployment line. My wife left me 3 times. She hated show business. I finally got her back. I got her and the kids out here in an apartment. I can't even make rent money. I'm drawing unemployment. I'm struggling. And that night, I finally got an audition for The Tonight Show weeks before that, and I got to The Tonight Show. I succeeded. They get me there, and they bumped me. I got in makeup, put you in the dressing room, bring you down to the green room, and they ran out of time. You got to come back next week. I come back the next week. I get makeup, go to my dressing room, bring me back down to the green room. They ran out of time. They bumped me 3 times in a row.
Oh.
The fourth time I'm there, I'm in makeup, and Fred the Cordova, the producer, came in, and he said, I got bad news for you. I said, what? He said, you're going on tonight. Now, a lump gets in your throat about the size of a grapefruit, and I'm trying to be this calm comedian, but now they come and get you. Bert Convy was on the show that night with Carol Burnett, and Bert Convy was singing a song. They said, they came and got me out of the green. They said, when the song is over, you know, they're going to go to commercial break, and then you'll be on. And the coordinator brings you all the long walk, all the way around to the back of the curtain, behind the curtain there.
Uh-huh.
And now, when you're a veteran of The Tonight Show, all the other stagehands, hey, Dreesen, how's your Cubs? You know, hey, Tommy, how you doing? Hey, have fun out there tonight. But your first time, when you're walking, they all turn their back on you and they whisper, "It's his first time. It's his first time." You know, they whisper. Now, I get behind the curtain. The coordinator said, "Are you okay, Tommy? His name is Craig Tennis." I said, "Yeah, I'm fine." He said, "Okay, Tommy, have fun." And now I'm walking back there by myself, and Doc Severinsen's playing because they're in a commercial break. And all of a sudden, I say, "I can't remember my first line. Wait, what's my first line? Oh yeah, now you're talking to God one on one. Oh Lord, please, you brought me this far." Now, not only if you bomb here tonight, not only did all the coordinators and all the Vegas buyers and stuff, they all watch that show. Mm-hmm. If you bomb tonight, you know, that's the end of it. Not only that, my mother had everybody back in Harvey, Illinois watching. So if I bomb, I couldn't even go back home. You know, now music stops and your heart stops. And Johnny says, "We're back now, and I'm glad you're in such a good mood tonight, because my next guest is making his first appearance on The Tonight Show." That one line, "I'm glad you're in such a good mood tonight," that one beautiful line from Johnny Carson that I'll always hold him so near and dear to my heart. He never does it again, but that first night.
Yeah.
And then he said, "Welcome, please, Tom Jason." They open up that curtain, and you walk out into like you're in an operating room, bright lights hitting you. You can't see the audience. You can only see the on-camera on you with the red light. And you hit your mark on the floor. There's a mark they told you to hit. You hit that mark. Now you start your first joke. The audience is applauding, and I got a laugh. And then I did my second joke, and it got a laugh. And then I did my third joke, and it got applause and a laugh. Then the fourth joke, I heard Johnny and Ed McMahon behind me laughing. Mm. And it was like a breath of fresh air. And now I'm on a roll. Now I got them. Boom. Laugh after laugh. Applause, applause. I got like eight applause. And I closed with, I said, "You've been a wonderful audience. This is my first appearance on The Tonight Show. And show business is a tough life. So if you like me, just if you like me, and you're Protestant, say a prayer. If you're Catholic, light a candle. If you're Jewish, somebody in your family owns a nightclub. Tell them about me, will you please?"
Oh,
and man. Then I walked off, and Johnny, the coordinator, come running around. I was back through the curtain. People were applauding, and he come running around. He said, go back. I said, "Go back and sit by Johnny." He said, "Don't go sit by Johnny, just go back." So I went back through the curtain. They gave me a second bow, and I went through the curtain, and Johnny gave that little circle with his finger.
Yeah.
You know, a little circle.
Yeah.
And I went back through, and people mobbed me, and I never stopped working since that night.
Oh,
I did 61 appearances on The Tonight Show, but I never stopped working. And I'll always thank Johnny Carson for that. And I did so many times, you know.
And you know what? You wonder why I get goosebumps when I'm reading this book, and now you're bringing it to life in your own voice. And I'm thinking of millions of people watch Johnny every night. The whole world ran through Carson. And you're exactly right. And the odds of all the nuances that got you to that stage, all the jobs you took in the Navy and all the ups and downs, the ins and outs. And I can imagine all your family and friends back in Harvey in the bars with the TV on. Shut up. Tom's on. And I watched this and, you know, the first thought is, was this, I don't know if the difficult is the right word, Tom. What was it like for you to offer all this up in a book, to go through it, to decide what goes in, what goes out, almost a purge in some ways? What was the experience of putting this book together of a lifetime for you?
Well, you know, I for years I wrote everywhere I went. I would, when I toured with Sammy, if something, as you said earlier, if something gave me goosebumps, I wrote it down. You know, if something, you know, and so many times I said, "God, you're a long way from Harvey, Illinois guy. Mm. Man, you're a long way from you. You'd be at these functions or something." And you know, when I first went to Frank Sinatra's home, and when I, you know, and you know, when Frank brings me back on stage again, or some, "You're a long way from Harvey." You know, when Dean Martin and I are playing golf, I'm saying, "Man, are you a long way from Harvey?" You know, that happened so many times, those moments, that I start writing them down. And I was going to write a book once called Opening Act, because I opened for so many people in my career, you know, from not only Frank, Sammy, and Dean, but Smokey Robinson, Natalie Cole, Gladys Knight and the Pips, Tony Orlando and Don, Frankie Avalon, James Barron. I'm leaving out a lot of people.
Sure.
I was going to call the book Opening Act, you know, but then I had all these notes and all this stuff, and then A couple of years ago, two guys, Darren Grubb from Texas and John Russo from New York, called me on a conference call, said, "We would love for you to do a book. We would like to help you write a book." And I said, "I've got it written. I've already written it. But what I needed help was the narrative and all that stuff."
Sure.
So they helped me a great deal. I would send them a chapter, and they would say, "That's fantastic." I said, "One thing, I don't want to have a book that aren't my words. If they aren't my words, I don't want a book out there." I will never want to say, oh, I didn't say that, or I didn't mean that.
Right.
No, I stand by every word written in there. Because every chapter I attend to them, they might say, oh, that's good, but let's take that one sentence out, and we put it in chapter 17? Because they knew how to make this the hook and the flow and the narrative, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So they helped me a great deal. And a little over a year ago, about 2 years ago, we started this, I think, a year and a half, 2 years ago, and we finally got it out. And I tell you, I'm really happy with it. It's getting great reviews, and I'm pleased. You know, I tell you the truth, there's another whole book in me that I didn't even talk about. I don't know if I ever want to do another book, but
yeah.
There's a lot of things when I read the book, I said, I should have said this,
yeah, right.
I should have told them about that, you know.
Well, it's
but it was fun.
It was a comprehensive glimpse into your life, and to me, even though I'm sure this is being pitched as an entertainment book and all that stuff, this is far more, at least it is to me, Tom, about hard work, discipline, direction, faith, faith in yourself, faith in something bigger than you. Be willing to stick your nose out. A lot of the things, you know, we hear this all the time, especially these days, that, you know, there's a, you know, take a course, and you know, 9-day course and get to success. And I've never seen anybody, nor do I know anybody, who's ever taken a shortcut to real success. Outside of all the great stories, you know, all of that stuff, that's great. But underneath it, I keep seeing this, like you said, here's this, what's a long way from Harvey, but isn't, I think we all need a little Harvey in ourselves is what I guess I'm getting. That's what I got out of the book. It reminded me of growing up in Chicago and doing jobs I didn't want to do at 3 o'clock in the morning and working construction and all the stuff that I did. There was a kinship there. And I think anybody who's ever had to work from nothing, or at least the bottom to get to some rung on the ladder, they're going to resonate with this, whether that was the intent or not.
Well, you know, I there was a work ethic growing up. My older brother, Glenn, really was an influence on me. He was 3 years older than me, but he was the one who took me with that, you know, taught me how to shine shoes, taught me how to set pins and bowling alleys, taught me how to caddy. And you know, there's a mantra when I was growing up, you only deserve in life what you work for, you know. And I'll tell you, my proud Irish mom, I'll never forget, in that shack we lived in, every Christmas and every Thanksgiving, the civic groups, the Kiwanis, the Moose, the Elks, the JCs, all those those people would come with, I'm trying to think of the Catholic group too. Anyhow, but they would come and they'd bring baskets of fruit and turkey and ham and all that kind of stuff. Stuff my brothers and sisters and I had never seen. And my proud Irish mother would say, no, we can't accept that. My husband has a job. And we can't accept that. And us kids were trying to crawl around the door and grab it. but she was right. My dad had a job, and he should have been taking care of us.
Yeah.
She was right. I'll never. And also, two things resonated with me my whole life. She was right on that. And the other issue was, it wasn't the government coming to feed us. It was people helping people, neighbors helping neighbors. And that's when I made up my mind when I got older, I was going to do the same thing. That's why I joined the JCs and all the civic groups and stuff. You know, because it's, if you leave Americans alone, they are the most generous, benevolent people in the world. They won't let a neighbor starve.
Yep.
You know, I think the biggest mistake we ever made was the welfare system. It was supposed to be for temporarily till you got on your feet, not six generations.
Right.
You know, in a classic example, and you and I talk about this in the Illinois Fatherhood Initiative, but in 1960 in Harvey, 4% of the children were being born without a father in a home. Today, 75%.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
Where did that all begin in that war on poverty? 3 out of every 10 white families in America are born without a father. 3 out of every 10 white children born without a father in a home today. 5 out of every 10 Hispanic and 7 out of every 10 African-American are born without a father in a home. When I was growing up in Harvey, the mantra was this simple, very simple. If you get a girl pregnant, you marry her. When I was 13 years old, my mother said, if you get a girl pregnant, you'll stand by her. Mom, I'm 13 years old. If you get a girl pregnant, you'll stand by her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the mantra in the white, in the Italian neighbor, the Irish neighbor, the Polish neighbor, the African-American neighbor. That was the mantra. And they would come and get a kid and say, come here, you got that girlfriend, you're going to marry her. I don't want to marry her. Well, then you're going to take care of the child, because if you don't, we have to.
Yeah.
Then along came the war on poverty, well-intentioned, but misinformed.
Yep.
You have one baby out of wedlock, we give you $250. But if you have two babies from two different men, you get $500. And if you have three babies from three different men, $750. And by the way, if one of those men is living with you, cohabitating, you get nothing. Guess what that promoted?
Yeah.
Guess what that did?
You know, Tom, years ago, I had to go in my daughter. I donated a kidney to my daughter when she was 13. And I
God bless you.
And I had to, well, thanks. And I had to, I had to go to the Social Security office for something to get signed off. I, you know, we had insurance, but there was some auxiliary stuff that needed to be paid. And I remember sitting in the waiting room, and there was this young guy next to me, and he had a bunch of kids and this and that. And I said, you know, we're just talking. I said, are you in here for, you know, some medical stuff? He goes, no, I'm here just because I get paid to be here. I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, I got these kids and do this. And I said, well, why aren't you just at work? He goes, I make more money sitting here having kids than I do working. And it was, whether it was a black or Italian or a German or Hispanic, I don't care who you are. It's a mentality. And I went into the office to get the paper signed, and the woman says, oh, your daughter, you know, she could get SSID. She could be declared disabled, and she can get checks till she's 18, and she'll get X amount. I said, I am not going to tell my daughter that she's disabled because she had a kidney transplant. Because then that'll put that seed in there that somehow disability brings along with it profitability, and I'm not doing it. And my daughter and I, she's 31 now and doing pretty well. And we had this talk, and I told her that story. She didn't know about it till later. And she said, you know, Dad, she said, I'm so glad you didn't do that. Not that it would ever have become an issue with her, but it shouldn't even be thought of at all. And here was this well-intentioned program to help people who have some real disabilities. And all I had to do was sign a piece of paper. They ended up giving me $1,800 a month. And she, oh, you could use it for a car or whatever. Like, are you shitting me? So there's a mentality thing here that I think our 20th century brains, Tom, are reptilian brainstems. And, we're both kind of stegosaurus here. Like, you work for what you get. You play hard, you earn hard, and you give back. And I think if you do that, that's kind of where success is at anyway.
No question. When I was growing up, we were more afraid of our fathers than we were of the police.
Yeah.
You know, and whatever neighborhood you were in Harvey, you know, and I grew up in a predominantly black area, the black men in that community would walk the streets, and if they saw a kid snatching a purse or being crude to somebody, they would bring that kid home to his father.
Right.
You know, Gucci and I one night were setting pins in a bowling alley, coming back late, and the cops pulled us over. What are you guys doing out so late? And we said, we're setting pins. They said, okay, get in the car, we'll give you a ride home. And Gucci said, please, officer, please. Please don't give me a ride home. You'll never see me on the street again. And Gucci was a tough guy.
Mm-hmm.
But anybody, he said, if I come home in a squad car, my father, there'll be hell to pay.
Yep.
We were more afraid of our fathers than we were of the police. That the stuff on the south side of Chicago doesn't shock me. Everybody's saying, well, you know what we need to do, and how did that happen? It isn't rocket science. So, you know, you've got a grandmother who's got four grandbabies, not the mother of those children, the grandmother, and she's trying to keep those kids away from the gangs, and she's got a broomstick, and the gang's got an AK-47.
Right.
Guess who's going to win that fight? You know, when men roamed the streets, fathers roamed the streets, that wasn't like that. Yeah. And they keep, and the only thing that would save it, politicians are going to have to come out and say, America, we made a terrible mistake. We meant well, misinformed. We made a terrible mistake, but they're never going to do that. They're never going to do that. And you keep sometimes pouring in trillions of dollars into the war on poverty and things like that, and that isn't the answer. The answer is getting back to the morality. The Constitution was found basically on the Ten Commandments. It isn't rocket science. Thou shalt not steal. That's it.
That's
Thou shalt not kill. That's it. You know what I mean? It isn't rocket science. You know, we will never be destroyed from without because we're too strong a military, and the world knows that. But we can be destroyed from within, and that's the breakdown of the family structure.
If you ever read Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, that seems to be that's the playbook we're in. Last few minutes here on a much higher note, Tom. Much higher note, which was well explained and needs to be said. You received the Ellis Island Medal of Honor back in 2005, and you fulfilled a promise. What was that?
Well, when I was a little boy, as you read in the book, I kept thinking, I don't look like my brothers and sisters. You know, I look like my cousins. You know, my mom was a bartender in a bar that her sister and her husband owned. My mom's brother-in-law was a man named Frank Polizzi. And when I was a little boy shining shoes in all the bars, I'd go to his bar last because my mom was a bartender and because he told jokes behind the bar. And he sang and he told jokes, and I really admired him a great deal. And I used to tell his jokes, some many that should not be told on a Catholic school playground, when I was a little boy. But you know, I loved him. He was my favorite uncle, and he loved me. But as I was a little boy, when I was 10 and 11 and 12 years old, people would say, hey, Polizzi, hey. I'd say, no, my name isn't Polizzi, my name is Dreesen. Hey, Polizzi, well, I kept looking, and I looked so much like his two sons. And my brother had blonde hair and blue eyes, you know, and I had black hair and brown eyes, you know. Anyhow, so long story short, when I start learning where babies came from, I didn't want to think that my mom and dad did this, let alone my mom and my uncle, you know,
right.
Her brother. Yeah, but one day I went for a walk, and he was a real tough guy. Didn't take a whole lot of guff from anybody, but I went to talk to him, and he said, "What is it?" And we went for a walk, and I said, "I think that you're my father." And he said, "What makes you think that?" And I was afraid of him because he was also a very tough guy. I said, and I told him the reasons. I don't look like my brothers and sisters. And everywhere I go, people say, "Hey, Pelosi." Finally, he said, "Okay." He said, "It's true. But you can tell everybody, and it would ruin your mom and dad's marriage, and it would ruin mine." Because it was a secret that him and my mom had, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, whenever people say, "Hey, Pelosi," I'd say, "My name is Pelosi. Pelosi's my uncle." "Oh, okay." I think they kind of thought maybe that my mom was his sister, you know. Anyhow, long story short, it became our secret, and I kind of frayed away from him a little. I was a little uncomfortable around him. I went in the Navy, and when I came home, we became friends again, and we became real close. It was our little secret, and no one knew it at the time, and we kept it that way. But then on his deathbed, when I went to see him, he said to me, "Do you have any regrets because of our situation?" And I said, "No." He said, "You don't have to tell me the truth now just because I'm dying, you know. You can." I said, "No, I don't. Do you, I said, "I feel fine about it. Do you have any regrets?" He said, "The only thing I regret is that whenever I'd see you on TV, if I was in a bar with my friends and you were on TV or something, I couldn't tell people, 'Hey, that's my kid.'"
Mm.
And I said, "One day I will receive an award." And I said, "Everything I do, I emulated you." I said, "One day I'll receive an award in show business and I'll dedicate it to you." And that was the first time I ever saw tears in his eyes. He leaned, because he was a tough Sicilian, you know.
Yeah.
He looked the other way and he had tears in his eyes. And then in 2005, I received the Ellis Island Medal of Honor Award on Ellis Island, where he came as a six-year-old. He came on the SS Italia from Italy to this country. And so when I received the award, I was standing not too far from where he first arrived.
Wow.
And I dedicated it to him. I said, "I accept this award in the name of my biological father, Frank Blakey."
Hmm. Think of the two Franks in your life. You mentioned in the book they were similar in many ways.
Yeah, and structure, too. They were both about the same size. Both were wiry, tough little shits, you know. And both didn't take a whole lot of guff from anybody.
Yeah.
Frank Pelosi was a singer. He had a band called Frank Pelosi and the Venetianeers. You know, I wish they would have met. He would have loved.
Wow.
They would have liked each other, I think. They were two cut from the same stone, you know.
Mm. You know, last thing I ask everybody, and this is even more of a loaded question to you than most people I talk to, Tom, because of your... It is rare. I've been doing radio 25 years, thousands of shows, talked to everybody I'd ever wanted to, and even a few that I didn't, but I did it anyway. And everybody has a story. Everybody has a path. Everybody has a journey. And maybe part of my the partiality I have to your journey is because Harvey's not too far from where I'm sitting right now, and I get it. And I've watched you on TV and doing these things, and you know, we had the chance to spend time together a couple years ago, and I see... When the spotlight's not away, that you're just as giving an intention with these messages and things to people that need it, even if it's not on a stage somewhere. So I see the roundedness of that and the continuity in that. But when I went through the whole book, and this is where it comes to me, is like, is there like a big aha for you at this point in your life? You've written the book. You've had an incredibly successful career. What's the big aha? What's the big takeaway for you at this point in your life?
As to what my philosophy on the future or the past?
There's no wrong answer, brother.
When I look back, when I wrote the book and I sat down and I read the final copy, it was almost like the line in Frank Sinatra's "My Way," to think I did all that, you know, to think I did all that, you know, you look back, but you know, that along the way, there's two things that I realize that a human being... I used to always wonder, what is the yin and the yang? When I was reading books about yin and yang, I said, I didn't quite understand that. But the more I read, the more I realized that we're two parts. We're ego and we're spirit. You know, call it what you want, your Holy Spirit, your center, whatever you want. But that when we're born, we're not born ego. We're born pure spirit. We don't know if we're boy or girl, black or white, Jew or Gentile. We're just a spirit. And we love everything that loves us, and we gravitate to those that love us and hug us and hold us. So we're spirit. Well-intentioned adults, sometimes misinformed, start to program our computer. Little boys do this, little girls do that. We Jews do this, we Catholics do that, whatever. By the time you're 4 or 5 years old, you start developing an image of yourself based upon their opinion. And thus the ego is formed. And the rest of your life, That's your yin and yang. You fight that ego and that spirit, ego and the spirit, and you try to keep the spirit. What I realized is that I was ego-driven many times, and other times I was spirit-driven. And the spirit is who you really are. The ego has an insatiable appetite. It will drive you. It will keep you, drive you until you one day fail. It can never get enough fame, fortune, money, power, not enough of any of that. And so eventually it'll drive you to failure. But the spirit, conversely, is like the song of the 70s by the Hollies. All I need is the air that I breathe and to love you. That's all your spirit needs. So what I gather is that, like, if you're driving down the street and a guy pulls in front of you and you slam on your brakes and you start cursing and you run, that's your ego. Your spirit says, oh, am I glad no one was hurt. I hope he goes on his way and has a safe day, and you wave at the person. That's what I want to strive to be, is the spirit up front more than the ego. And that's my yin and my yang. And so I always want to see things, hopefully, through the spirit in me. That's what I was born, spirit. I wasn't born ego.
So I'm going to leave that right there. I can't improve on everything that Tommy just said at the end of that podcast. This is how you become successful in the world, first within, so you don't ever have to go without. I appreciate listening. Be well, safe travels, and until next time, adios.